From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. A 12-year-old died after being hit by a school bus while riding their bike on October 6th. More than 90 students have been struck by vehicles traveling to or from schools this year. That's more than double last year's number. Clark County and local municipalities have significantly stepped up efforts to increase safety. However, the accident rate continues to increase. Nevada Public Radio's Yvette Fernandez visited Rancho High School during a so-called saturation detail.
While Tanya and Robert Watts wait outside Rancho High School to pick up their kids, they see what they call problem behavior every day.
The kids are not walking on the crosswalk like they should. They're walking in between the cars. And the cars are just trying to fly through while the buses, they're trying to get the buses out. And sometimes they just jump right in front of the cars.
Because right now it's just a chaos. They're just going through buses. They're not using the crosswalk. They're just going out in traffic without even stopping. Just like right now behind me.
You get cars that are doing U-turns when they shouldn't be doing a U-turn. You'll catch them flipping around and almost hitting a kid that did actually go in the crosswalk.
Examples like this are why the southern Nevada cities of Henderson, Las Vegas, and North Las Vegas, as well as Clark County, are taking action. This school year, they allocated additional funding to hire a crossing guard company to place more guards at more elementary schools. It's around 2:30 p.m. on a drizzly September day outside Rancho High School, where I met the Watts parents. Students burst en masse from the building, dispersing in every direction. Cars are lined up along the street, waiting to pick up the students. Buses fill the parking lot. Everyone seems to be racing to get where they're going. Amid the chaos, the crossing guards themselves are too busy to stop what they're doing. But Lieutenant Michael Campbell with the Clark County School District's Traffic Division has a few minutes to talk. Campbell tells me the number of kids being struck by cars has increased this year.
We're at 54 this year.
54 kids have been struck at school?
Yeah, so almost double. And then this time 2 years ago was at about 35. So this is our highest year ever.
He says the additional crossing guards seem to have helped at elementary schools, but the accident rate has actually increased at high schools. Since our interview, Lieutenant Campbell says the number of students being hit in school zones has increased to 94, and there have been two fatalities this month. Campbell says autos aren't always to blame. Sometimes it's the kids.
A lot of the times the kids are just walking out or darting out into the street on their bikes. And, you know, about half of them are of our crashes are due to kids on these e-bikes now, on the e-scooters.
Those I talk to blame the problem on everyone being in their own world, focused on their phones and not paying attention to what's going on around them. Bus driver Alejandro Navarro says he often encounters drivers who simply ignore the stop arm on his school bus.
Those lights come out, and some people just pass right at it, and they don't even pay attention to the bus. So people just be looking at their phones, and they don't pay attention to what's going on the street.
Navarro and his colleague Alejandro Caballero both drive buses for special needs students and say they take their jobs seriously.
There is a lot of responsibility what I got on board. They're not my child, so anything what's going on to the child, it's on me. So I'm very, very careful what I'm doing on my job.
This fall, the school district formed a new working group consisting of law enforcement, school teachers and administrators, city and county officials, and parents. It's supposed to address the issues complicating school traffic safety.
For instance, this school that we're standing on right now is North Las Vegas that you're standing. Across the street is the city of Las Vegas. So if a crosswalk needs help on this side of the street where it's not connecting safely to the other side of the street, now it's going to take at least two cities to fix it. And some of those schools are surrounded by four different, it could be the city of Las Vegas on one side, North Las Vegas, and the county, unincorporated Clark County on another side, plus the school district needing to be involved. So those discussions are now happening.
Another problem, the logistics of policing the country's fifth largest school district, It's an equation that can't be solved by additional policing alone, says Lieutenant Campbell.
There's just so many schools, and that's 300,000 students. And busing alone is something that's just huge, because it's 1,500 bus routes every day with 36,000 different bus stops. So when somebody's like, why can't the school police get out here to these bus stops? But again, there's like 30 patrol officers and then the six guys on bikes. And it's like, yeah, we try to follow a bus around here or there, but 36,000 bus stops is a lot.
On this one day, Lieutenant Campbell says 16 officers who were policing more than 20 schools wrote over 100 citations. Parents Tanya and Robert Watts support more punitive actions, such as tickets for parents and students who break traffic laws.
These kids got it so easy, and their parents don't want to be accountable. And they don't want to, they want to blame everything on the staff or the school. It's easy, see? Running right in the street. Now, if there was a car coming, hit a brake, the parents would want to blame Rancho High School.
There should be a staff there making sure they're using that crosswalk.
Ultimately, parents, bus drivers, and law enforcement say it's up to everyone to be more aware and more responsible.
Parents need to be the ones accountability and hold their kids responsible too, not just the school district.
If we could be patient, if we could be kind to each other, if we could look out for each other, if we could treat each other like we're each other's family members, like each kid is your own child, each crossing guard is like, you know, they're somebody's grandmother, grandfather, aunt, uncle. All these people matter. They're lives. They're not obstacles. They shouldn't be treated like obstacles. I know that it's chaotic, but if everybody could be a little more patient, that's how we could get better.
The new working group is expected to meet later this fall to continue finding ways to improve safety around schools. Yvette Fernandez, KNPR News.
It's the time of year when people think about seasonal vaccines, and with Nevada ranked the second worst state in the nation for vaccination rates, experts are insistent that locals get their shots. But things will be different this year, at least for COVID boosters. Earlier this year, the Food and Drug Administration approved the updated versions, but with a caveat. They're only recommended for people 65 and older, as well as those with serious health conditions. Others, the CDC now says, should speak to their doctors about before receiving the shot. So what does that mean for people who want the COVID booster? KNPR producer Ann Davis spoke with Chris Elena Mariano, the Southern Nevada Health District's community health nurse and supervisor on immunizations, for her advice about getting up to date on the COVID vaccine.
Dr. Mariano, welcome to State of Nevada.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start with what's on a lot of people's minds and news feeds this fall, COVID shots and the CDC and FDA's updated guidance on those. How has that changed who can get this season's new COVID boosters?
So as of October 6th of this year, the CDC, or the Center of Disease Control and Prevention, has adopted individual-based as well as a clinical shared place model for COVID vaccinations. And what this means is that the vaccination is based on an individual's personal preference, on their healthcare circumstances, and in the contents of shared clinical decision-making of immunizations. The CDC defines healthcare providers as anyone who provides or administers vaccines, such as physicians, physician's assistants, nurse practitioners, registered nurses, and pharmacists. They can reach out here to the health district at one of our immunization locations to discuss their options on that.
So it sounds like this is going to be a situation where people now have to get a prescription from their primary care physician or general practitioner to get a COVID booster, or is that not true for everybody now?
No, they do not need to receive a prescription for the vaccine.
Okay, so I could just go to a clinic or to a pharmacy and say, you know, I've discussed this with my doctor. We've agreed that this is the best decision for me. And then I would be able to actually receive the vaccine then, it sounds like.
So I'm not sure if you're just pertaining to all pharmacies. I can't verify or see what the other pharmacies are requesting for. But here at the Southern Nevada Health District, we are providing the COVID vaccine, and they do not need to receive a prescription.
Okay. And what about the guidance from the FDA that says that it is only recommended now for people who are 65 and older or people with comorbidities or conditions that would predispose them to a more severe COVID infection? How is that? Is that going to have any impact on who can get the vaccine or not? Or once again, is this just everybody who wants it can go talk to their doctor and then get the shot?
So currently, there's a release that states that the vaccine is available for anyone who's over the age of 6 months. The COVID vaccine is currently authorized and recommended by the CDC and are approved for individuals 6 months and older and are consistent with the FDA authorization.
Okay. And beyond health district clinics, where else can Southern Nevadans get their vaccines? Are these still all at pharmacies, you know, flu, COVID, RSV? Are they at general practitioners' offices as well?
So the Southern Nevada Health District does offer these seasonal vaccines. I would always also look to your local pharmacies as well, and then also to some of your local providers. Not always provided at some of your local providers, but then they can always reach out to their pharmacy or the Southern Nevada Health District.
All right. Dr. Chris Elaine Mariano is the community health nurse supervisor on immunizations for the Southern Nevada Health District. Dr. Mariano, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it, too.
Of course. And we will have links to more resources on seasonal vaccines on our website at knpr.org.
Since 2010, Nevada has gained an average of 24,000 new residents annually. But according to research by the Gwynn Center for Policy Priorities, the housing supply has struggled to keep up. Rising construction costs, outdated zoning regulations, and slow permitting processes have all worsened the problem. Additionally, barriers to development on federal land and an influx of wealthier out-of-state buyers and low wages in the hospitality sector further put strain on affordability. One area of the state that has long struggled with housing is Lake Tahoe. With its pristine waters and world-class skiing, the basin draws hundreds of thousands of visitors a year, with some of them staying for good. And for the thousands of people who keep Tahoe running, from teachers to restaurant staff to mental health advocates, finding a place to live that's safe, affordable, and near their work is often out of reach. As part of a housing series from our sister station KUNR in Reno, Maria Palma has this story.
Stephanie Rodriguez, a victim support advocate, grew up and works in Incline Village. For over 30 years, she called Tahoe home, but recently a few issues forced her to leave.
Honestly, two things. One of them was rent being so high, and another one, child care being super expensive out here. And with my two-year-old, I couldn't do both. It was like either both or something way cheaper.
Now living in Carson City, she commutes an hour each way, spending nearly $300 a month on gas. The emotional cost is even higher.
I've been homesick. I'm not going to lie to you. I've been homesick to Tahoe and like I've been into Silo. Like I'm just going to see if I can find anything for a place here. Something similar to what I'm renting in Carson, it's like $3,000. That plus babysitter, I'm like, no, there's nowhere I'm going back to Tahoe anytime soon.
Some efforts are underway to ease the crisis. Across the region, jurisdictions including Placer County and Washoe County are experimenting with a mix of solutions, like offering down payment assistance for local buyers and incentivizing the conversion of short-term rentals back into long-term homes. Programs like PlaceMate continue to incentivize lease to locals and unlock existing housing. Justin Osuna stands behind the bar at Sagely, mixing a drink. He's the restaurant manager, but also fills in as bartender when needed. Like many who work in Incline Village, he commutes daily from his home in Sparks, nearly an hour away.
For me, it's about being able to just securely and financially be able to provide for me and my daughter. I am a single dad. So it is far too expensive for me to afford to live out here. So it has kind of taken that option out for me.
In Sparks, he shares a spacious home with a roommate in Tahoe. That same price wouldn't get him much.
Right now, I have a roommate. We have a, I think it's 1,800 square foot, three bedroom, two bath home for $2,200 a month. At that price point here around the lake, that's not really getting you much.
Still, he believes any solution must be inclusive, especially for seasonal and international workers.
Affordable housing is important and has to be a option, particularly for those from out of state, particularly for those from out of country. We need infrastructure to be able to support that.
Down the shore, on the southern edge of the lake, Nicholas Edge faces a different view of the same crisis. He works in South Lake Tahoe as a mental health case manager and pays nearly $2,200 a month for one side of a duplex. Even with more than 15 years in his field, homeownership feels out of reach.
Yeah, I'm 37 years old, and you know, I've been in my field 15 odd years, and to be in my field, being successful in my field, and still having to feel like I have to have roommates if I was on my own, it can get a little discouraging.
Housing prices have increased, while wages, even for professionals, haven't kept up.
I mean, I think it could definitely be a little bit less. I mean, compared to when I first moved here to now, like housing prices as well as just rental prices have gone up exponentially, and that's only in a few years.
In South Lake Tahoe, one of the biggest moves has been Sugar Pine Village. Built on former state land, this project will eventually total 248 units of affordable housing. And organizations like the Tahoe Housing Hub are working on the issue through advocacy, preservation, and creative policy solutions.
We believe in housing for all, meaning access to housing that is appropriate, meets the needs of those who are living in that housing.
That's Aaron Casey, CEO of Tahoe Housing Hub. Their efforts go beyond new houses, focusing on keeping existing rentals affordable, she says.
The other big piece for us is in preservation and protection of existing rental units. So we want to be able to go in and purchase those units and keep the rents low, and also make sure that if there are improvements that need to be made on site, that those improvements take place. And so we would deed restrict those units and protect them in perpetuity and preserve them.
Casey explains that Tahoe's housing challenges stem from a combination of factors. It's a highly desirable place to live, but development has not kept pace with demand, largely due to the environmental protections necessary in a mountain town.
Tahoe is a beautiful place. It's a very desirable place to be. You've got a lot of demand and limited supply.
As for Rodriguez, she hopes that rent in Incline Village will become more affordable so she can move back with her children. She wishes families like hers won't be forced to leave the community they grew up in. For KUNR Public Radio, I'm Maria Palma, Lake Tahoe.
Of course, no one feels the impact of rising costs more than those who are already just scraping by, like young people starting out. All you have to do is look at the stats. Over the last 20 years, the number of first-time homebuyers has plummeted. In 2004, there were nearly 3.2 million first-time buyers, according to the National Association of Realtors. Last year, that number was a little bit more than 1.1 million. So how are groups like Gen Z, many of whom are just in college or just graduated college, coming to terms with the bleak housing landscape? KUNR's Muriel Day sat down with a few Gen Zers to find out more about their living situations.
On a warm Monday afternoon, Kai Stevens puts on his black button-up and black slacks. He combs his hair and removes any lint off his uniform. He then checks his watch and realizes it's time to leave for his evening shift at Outback Steakhouse. Stevens currently works part-time as a food runner. Just a few months ago, he was a biochem major at the University of Nevada, Reno. Towards the end of his sophomore year, he decided to take a gap year after being overwhelmed with financial responsibilities.
Mentally, there's a lot going on last year. I kind of feel like defeated a little bit. And having to go again and rely on my parents when I'm a full-grown adult again.
The 20-year-old lived in a four-bedroom, two-bath apartment at the Highlands. Steven says even when he chose the cheapest option, rent was still $700 a month. On top of that, he had to pay for his car insurance, gas, groceries, and tuition. He had loans and some scholarships to help pay for his school. Despite making a few thousand dollars per month, Steven says he was still financially struggling. Many Gen Zs like Steven's are either moving back home with their parents or have never moved out because of costly expenses like rent. Dr. Jody Dorkin is a professor at University of Minnesota. She says a lot of jobs nowadays don't pay enough for people to live on their own. By living in a shared space, Gen Z can also contribute to the family expenses.
So we're just not paying people what we should. And housing prices have skyrocketed in ways that are just unaffordable. And loans are, like, interest rates are ridiculous. So, I mean, I think there's sort of this whole economic perspective.
Not even a decade ago, it was estimated an adult living on their own was spending about $7,500 annually on rent in Nevada. But that amount has doubled this year. A recent report by Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies says half of all renters in the U.S. spend more than 30% of their income on rent and utilities. Rue Jimenez currently works full-time for Goodwill, making $17 an hour. Jimenez was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder recently. By living at home with her mother, she is able to use her paycheck to cover her medical bills and prescriptions. Jimenez is 23 years old. She had to drop out of college because of her mental illness and has been having a hard time getting a good paying job since.
Because knowing that I'm like getting older but still at home with my parents, it does like bring up feelings of shame and guilt.
Jimenez lives with her mother, her sister, and her mother's husband in an apartment. She says everyone contributes to paying rent and bills. According to Zillow, the average home value in Nevada is almost $500,000. Jimenez's other sister moved to Kansas with her husband in order to afford a house. Jimenez says she will probably have to do the same thing if she ever wants a shot at becoming a homeowner.
Oh, you're going as well, Mom?
Well, she's
going
to hang out with them, dude.
Do you want me to stick around here?
Back at Steven's parents' house, Kai says he plans to keep living at home for now. He wants to save as much money as he can before living on his own again.
I really try to not be a burden, but I do feel like I am.
Steven says having to live with parents as an adult can be difficult, but it's a decision many Gen Zs are forced to take. Mariel Day, KUNR News.
With me now to talk about their reporting are Mariel Day and Maria Palma, both with our sister station KUNR in Reno. Maria, Mariel, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Maria, let's start with you. Tahoe, much like Southern Nevada, is a tourism-based economy. What do we know about the folks that currently live around the lake?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's a tourism-based economy, like you said. In my reporting, we heard the story, and I feel like I kept hearing the same story from different people, local workers who just couldn't afford to live there near their jobs anymore. And, you know, everything from restaurant staff to mental health professionals are having to commute long distances or leave the region entirely. So that's when I realized it wasn't just a housing issue, but also it's a workforce stability and community health issue.
So where is the workforce living? Are they living in the Reno Tahoe or in the Reno Sparks area?
Yeah. So around 50% of the workforce in Tahoe, they either commute from Carson City, from Reno or Sparks. So that's probably like a 30, 40 minute to even an hour commute to at least North Lake Tahoe. If you think about like South Lake Tahoe, that is like an hour and a half. So they're probably commuting from those areas. If not, they are splitting a condo, like a duplex. They're definitely living with roommates. They're not living by themselves. Like it's not a thing in Tahoe that you can share. I mean, that you can live by yourself in a studio or like a one bedroom apartment. You definitely have to share a unit.
So break down some of the key numbers that stood out to you from your reporting.
Yeah, so in my reporting, there are several important numbers. For example, one report estimates that the North Tahoe area needs about 1,200 new housing units by 2026. And most of those need to be affordable. In South Lake Tahoe, the number is even higher, over 3,200 units. And in the Truckee Tahoe region, the housing demand is about 8,000 units. Another big number, like I said, is that 50% of the workforce commutes to Tahoe, and 44% of homes in the region are vacant for pretty much most of the year, and they're basically second homes or vacation rentals.
You know, Tahoe, like many communities around the state, is surrounded on all sides by federal and state land. Is that one of the reasons why it's so hard to build more housing in Tahoe?
It is one of the reasons, but I feel like when we talk about why it's so hard to build in Tahoe, you have to consider many factors. One of the main challenges is environmental regulation, because Lake Tahoe is so environmentally sensitive. There are very strict rules about where and when you can build, and those are regulated by the TRPA, so that's Tahoe Regional Planning Agency. And also the construction season is very short due to the snow. So like, for example, right now, like they're not building, they're not constructing because it's not construction season. And land is also limited. Also, construction costs are higher than other areas. And even when there's demand, building more homes is complicated and expensive. And another factor is that with increased density, there's always the concern for wildfire risk. If you've been to Tahoe, you know that there's one road and it's very, you know, narrow and curvy, and, you know, you have two lanes and that's it. So like, you know, building more, it's not like you can just build a very tall building with 1,000 units, like hundreds of units, because it's really not the reality of a mountain region.
Muriel, let's focus on you for a second. Your reporting focused largely on young people affected by the housing shortage. As you noted, they're living at home longer. Did you talk to the families at all? I know the young man you spoke with, Kai, he said he felt like a burden. Is it a burden on the heads of these households, on these parents, for these young people to be back at the home?
Yeah, so Kai definitely feels like a burden having to move back in with his parents because he didn't want to add more to his parents' expenses and worries. But I did get to talk to Kai's parents, and they said, you know, they don't think he's a burden. It's just a big adjustment right now for everyone, especially since they didn't expect them to be back after having moved out already. But after seeing their own son struggling financially, mentally, and also one night Kai told me that he broke down to his parents because he just felt like everything was just too much and he was overwhelmed with having to pay for tuition, gas, car insurance, and all of that, and having to go to school and do a part-time job as well. So his parents immediately offered to take him back, and they said, you can come and live with us. So Kai does pay about $200 for rent to help out, and he helps out however he can. And that definitely helps with the new living situation.
Both of the young people you spoke to said they left college due to the rising cost of living. Correct me if I'm wrong, but aren't there financial aid programs designed to help students afford not just school, but also things like housing?
Yeah, so there are scholarships and financial aid geared towards helping paying extra costs like housing. But it's kind of hard unless you get a full ride tuition, that aid might not be enough to pay housing costs as well. I know a lot of students having to work multiple part-time jobs while going to school full-time so they can afford to live in student housing like the residence halls or an apartment in general. And for Kai and Rue, they have to juggle so many expenses. For Kai specifically, he has to take out loans to afford daily costs and also the tuition. So he just hopes to be able to pay off this loan with a job that he hopes to get after college.
Muriel, you're a young person. I have to ask, do you yourself feel locked out of the housing market?
Yeah, unfortunately, I do feel locked out of the housing market. I think knowing that the average housing price right now in Reno is almost $500,000 is just insane to think about. I don't know if I could ever afford that myself, and I might need help from somebody else, like maybe a partner in the future, to be able to afford a home or do what Rue's sisters did, which moved to Kansas, and maybe afford a house there instead.
Maria, we have about a minute left. You know, as a journalist, it feels like we talk a lot about housing, the housing situation in Nevada. Through your reporting, what do you think stuck out most for you?
So I feel like the bigger picture here is, you know, we're talking about housing, but we're also talking about how this is affecting the local economy and the workforce stability. I feel like businesses are struggling to hire and keep staff. Schools are seeing enrollment shifts. Many people are commuting long distances, like I said, which also affects quality of life and costs. And at the same time, fewer homes are available for full-time residents because of second home ownership and short-term rentals. So it's not only about housing, it's about mental health, like schools, stability, community. So I feel like that's the you know, it's a very, very big issue that is not only housing.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Maria Palma and Mariel Day are reporters for KUNR Public Radio in Reno. You can read the rest of the housing series online at KUNR.org. Nevada book lovers, this is your week. Each October, bibliophiles from all over the state and beyond gather at the historic Fifth Street School for the Las Vegas Book Festival. The three-decade-old institution celebrates authors and the written word through panel discussions, interviews, readings, and book-related activities for all age groups. And of course, vendors will be selling books. Desert Companion editor-at-large Scott Dickensheets is on the programming committee for the festival. He spoke with State of Nevada producer Mike Pravat recently about the festival's history and the offerings for this year's edition, which takes place Saturday, October 18th. And full disclosure, Nevada Public Radio is a book festival sponsor.
Scott, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Mike. Always happy to talk about books.
Well, this is your lucky day because we've got a huge book festival coming up. Obviously, you're a part of it. And I want to start and talk about another festival before we get into the one here in Vegas. You go to the Los Angeles Festival of Books every year. To put it one way, this is the Coachella of American book festivals. It draws 150,000 people a year. What do you experience there that makes it a permanent circle on your calendar?
Oh, a lot of things, Mike. You know, sort of a gathering of the book tribe for one. And it's nice to be among 150,000 people who think books are cool. And there's always like a bunch of great panels and authors you don't get a chance to see otherwise. Certainly authors who don't come through this town very often.
Right.
But there's also some things that, you know, that I use from that experience here with this book festival. It was at the LA Times Book Festival that I realized that discussion of books can be sort of a window onto the larger issues of society, of life, of politics. And I'm not just talking nonfiction either. Novels also, you know, reflect the times in which they're written. And so you can get writers talking, smart writers talking about sort of those elements of their books, and it sort of brings the backstory and the process alive. And then also I've met writers there that I've actually brought to the festival.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Leslie Jamison, one year, the year her first book, The Empathy Exams, popped big, I saw her at the LA Times Festival, and I got in her signing line immediately and said, "Will you come to our book festival, please?" And it turned out to be one of the best panels I've ever put together. So,
when you've done that, has the response generally been positive or resulted in a booking?
Typically, I mean, I would say about 75% of the writers that I approach don't turn me down flat, because there's always, like, you know, intrigue to a free trip to Vegas, right? So, but also the idea of talking about books in a place that's not known for that sort of intellectual activity, I think, intrigues a lot of them as well. So I think there's a higher interest than I might get if I was doing, like, you know, the Poughkeepsie Book Festival.
Right. The Las Vegas Book Festival debuted in 2002, and it is the biggest book event in the state. What have been the biggest differences or changes from those early days to these most recent editions?
Well, one of the biggest changes, and you can see it really plainly in the last 4 or 5 years, is a greater emphasis on book club type authors, you know, romance and, you know, fantasy, that sort of thing that people are passionate about, but often get overlooked by, you know, book festivals that are trying to build their cred on, you know, like high-end literary stuff.
Right.
And it's not like we eschew the high-end literary stuff. I mean, we've had some really famous authors at the festival, but, you know, with these book club type authors, we're seeing like long signing lines now, like 2 hours to get your book signed by, you know, like Rebecca Yarros or somebody like that, who, you know, they're not favored by the literati, but a lot of regular people are really into it.
When you are helping program this festival, are you thinking about what's ticking off your, like, personal book nerd boxes? Are you able to kind of, like, take what you want to see mostly in a book festival and push that to the committee and see if they agree with it?
Sure, it's a happy medium. I mean, some of my interests could get pretty wonky, but I do program out of my interest, and then I try and find a way to make it, give it a bit of a broader appeal, try and frame it in a way that's not just about some wonky subset of this subject, but that will attract more people.
I want to ask you about some of the bookings you've got here. If there is a headlining top of the bill author, it might be Taylor Jenkins Reid. Tell us about her and why you guys picked her.
She is the headline, top-ranking headliner. We picked her for this reason, that a lot of people might overlook her if they're only looking at sort of like, you know, the New York Review of Books or whatever. But her most recent book, Atmosphere, had a nice ride in the New York Times bestseller list. When I told my daughter-in-law, who's in a book club, that we were booking Taylor Jenkins Reid, like everybody in her book club was just a Twitter about this. So there's a high interest out there in writers like this. You know, she writes, you know, romance novels, but I understand, I'm not a reader of them myself, but I understand that, you know, that they defy some of the stereotypes of rom-com writing that you might imagine. They're more serious and more, and have deeper thoughts to them. All of that argued for someone like her to be in the top slot.
That is a great transition point for us, because there is also a Disney author panel. Work with me here for a second. These books are absolutely not for kids. I learned today that there is a series of books called Meant to Be that take the stories and characters of the Disney animated canon, Cinderella, Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, etc., and these authors turn them into adult romance novels, and they are published by Disney. So there's no explicit sex, but there's sexual innuendo and profanity. And I can't imagine, Scott, that this panel will not be a hit, if at least the lively newsroom discussion I had today is any indication. So it does raise the question, though, that is the adult romance genre so big that even Disney cannot refuse getting involved?
I think that's probably part of it. But I also think, you know, I mean, Disney's probably interested in expanding its own product line.
Sure.
And there's only so many things you can do for kids. And there's probably a way to spin some of these things for adults. And so that, I think that's probably a bit of calculated thinking on their part. But I do expect it to fill the auditorium, which is, you know, it's a big space. And I don't think there'll be, you know, very many free chairs. So I think this is the first time that all of the writers of this series will have been together in one panel.
Wow.
You know, that's kind of a milestone for that genre.
You know, you keep mentioning book clubs. I wonder if they're sort of the silent majority of the literary layout of the country.
I think they have a big influence because they, you know, they're organized and they, you know, they move in groups and whatnot. And they have a demonstrated interest in books. The books they read are typically probably not the sort of thing I personally am going to put on my nightstand, but I don't, you know, like look down my nose at the sort of books that they favor, because anybody reading is, in my book, a good thing. So I think they do have a lot of influence out there, yes.
Now, on the nonfiction side, a big event features two best-selling author journalists, Catherine Stewart and Tim Alberta. They have both written pretty heavy books on the intersection of religious extremism and politics in America. So what is the overall conversation that will happen at the festival?
It's definitely not side A versus side B kind of confrontational discussion. I think they're going to investigate, you know, the influence, as you say, of religion in modern life, which is as hot button a topic as there is in this country right now. And these are two people very qualified to talk about it. Tim Alberta, in fact, was at one of our previous book festivals at 3 or 4 years ago, I believe. And he was an electric presence on the stage. So he'll have a lot, he'll bring a lot of intelligence and passion to the discussion. And I've seen Catherine Stewart in other book festivals, and she's also an amazing speaker. So I think it'll be a great discussion of an airing out of this topic, but probably from a warning sort of standpoint, a be vigilant about what's going on sort of perspective, just judging by their books.
Now, when you say this is not going to be an A versus B kind of thing, are you being sort of mindful that there could be an audience member who's upset with how the conversation is going, or they ask a real divisive question that sort of throws the mood off? Is there ever concern that, you know, these things might get maybe a little hot?
Well, I think that's always a risk you take when you schedule a panel like this. I think it's important for people to know that books can be at the center of important conversations. That's the reason to schedule something like this. There's always going to be somebody in the audience who doesn't like what's being said. Although, you know, sometimes they don't speak up, sometimes they just get up and leave. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they will ask a hot question, and that's their right. When you pass around a microphone, that's likely to happen. And so, but these guys are all practiced speakers. They know how to answer the question without fueling the fire, I think.
So. Surely. We'd be remiss if we didn't mention the many local author events and discussions that are happening. So what's on offer? What are you maybe looking most forward to?
Well, there's a couple of local authors you might have heard of, Bob Miller and Richard Bryan, both former governors who will be on stage talking about their books, you know, in one session. We have a session about Las Vegas fiction and getting Las Vegas right in fiction, and that's all Douglas Unger, Megan Edwards, P. Moss, and then Todd Goldberg, who, you know, who writes the Gangsterland novel set in Las Vegas, has lived here, so he's kind of an honorary local. There's a great lineup of local poets like Harry Fagel and Miss A.V. and Rodney Lee and Vogue Robinson. They'll all be there talking about the craft of poetry and that sort of thing.
We were just talking about the nonfiction panel, and it makes me wonder if there's an easy answer for how a book festival in 2025 meets this current moment in America.
Well, I think just by being a book festival, you know, depending on your point of view, the country might be going to hell in a Project 2025 handbasket. But if you get together with a bunch of people for the optimistic embrace of reading, that hardly amounts to, you know, hashtag resistance, but it does amount to self-care in a troubled time. And I think that is what you can get from it. You can take solace in the fact that there are still these good things happening in the world, and there are serious people talking about serious things, but there's also fun people talking about fun things, and both are okay in this time, despite the, you know, however urgent you might feel the situation is.
The Las Vegas Book Festival takes place October 18th at the historic Fifth Street School. Scott Dickensheets is on the programming committee of that festival and the editor-at-large at Desert Companion. Scott, thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
Fourteen Las Vegas artists show their heritage through flags they created for the short film Unseen Territories. It premiered at the Nuu Art Gallery and Community Center in late September. Nevada Public Radio's Jimmy Romo attended the premiere and spoke with two of the participating artists, as well as the film's director.
For the climactic scene of the short film Unseen Territories, cars drive down Main Street in the Las Vegas Arts District brandishing flags. Some of the flags are attached to poles, some are draped over doors, others are being waved by smiling and cheering passengers. They represent how local artists identify with their own heritage. One of the film directors, Cindy Galindo, says the idea was sparked by the growing protest movement. For example, in the protests A Day Without Immigrants, many people flew Mexican and Central American flags.
A lot of people are like representing themselves through flags. So I wanted to see if we had an opportunity to create our own flags and design them to represent us, what would they look like?
Some of the artists connected with their indigenous roots through the creation of their flag. One flag pictured two women. On the left, a Native Hawaiian woman dancing hula in traditional dress. And on the right, a Mexican charro woman playing the guitar. The artist Riot.
I was raised by my Hawaiian mother and my Mexican father. And both of these things are important to me. I didn't want to just...
Called it Kanaka Chicana, representing her split heritage as half Hawaiian and half Mexican.
Growing up here on the mainland and also away from Mexico and not speaking Spanish, I always felt in this gray area, like I wasn't enough of one culture. But then I'd be with my Hawaiian family, they'd be like, you're too Mexican for us. And I'd be with my Mexican family, they'd be like, you're too Hawaiian for us.
Even though Riot felt alienated, both cultures still resonate with her. Her parents raised her to be proud of who she is and where she came from. She grew up playing the guitar and dancing hula, something her mom would try to incorporate at home.
I literally cannot think of a time where she didn't bring it up or even just did it for fun in the house. And I thought it was just a fond memory of her because in a sense, I also wanted to commemorate her in the flag as she passed away 2 years ago. It felt really nice to think of her while making it.
Another flag featured in Unseen Territories was a two-sided flag, where both sides had a red background.
This makes me feel like I belong. I'm doing what my ancestors would want me to do. I'm connecting with what my ancestors like how they want.
In yellow, Isaac Roman Quesada painted eyes, teeth, faces, and even a car coming out of the mist.
Almost like how I uncover the same history of my belonging and where I'm from, I use the faint shadows of the information I got through the Muslim to give me that information.
These flags allowed artists to reconnect with a history that society taught them to shun. Quesada didn't always self-identify as indigenous because his family denied that part of their heritage from Mexico.
I was raised, unfortunately, to ignore or to not acknowledge that past. My father would always say, you're not indigenous, you're Spanish.
Quesada and his youngest sister are attempting to find the roots of their family's traumas and dive deeper into their indigenous roots.
This inward toxicity and negativity towards one's true identity. And of course, it's heavily influenced with Catholicism, and that's kind of why it's stemming from that, because they fear being identified as indigenous can get them killed.
Galindo says her vision was to give artists like Quesada and Riot the space to look deeply into who they are and where they came from.
I'm an art curator here, and a big part of my method is having the artists do self-exploration. So I've done that in previous shows. I just love providing like a prompt and seeing what happens.
Unseen Territories will play at the Winchester Dondero Cultural Center on October 17th at 7 p.m. and will include a Q&A with the artist. Jimmy Romo, KNPR News.
As you know, there is absolutely no shortage of what to see, hear, and do at any time in our gorgeous state. Here to help us plan our week is Mike Pravat, who oversees the Arts and Culture Beat for Nevada Public Radio. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Paul.
I understand that you have a twofer at the Smith Center.
And between them, they're going to occupy Reynolds Hall for 10 days. So let's start with the Nevada Ballet Theater, who is bringing back Romeo and Juliet as choreographed by the company's former artistic director, James Canfield. He staged this back in May 2013, and it was a big deal for NBT back then because it had, up until that point, largely eschewed the story-based ballets. Obviously, Romeo and Juliet is one of the most well-known stories in history. It's been done and done and done before in just about every artistic medium. Canfield was very intentional in this version. This is a revision and refinement of his own work, especially with how the dancers would tell Shakespeare's tragedy with their bodies. For instance, how they needed to be subtle, but also expressive enough to actually tell the story. And anyone who missed this 12 years ago gets four more chances to do so October 17th through the 19th. Now, after NBT packs up its set, the touring musical Stereophonic takes over for nearly a week of performances. And this is a notable selection for the Smith Center's Broadway season. For one, it broke the record for Tony nominations for a single work. And two, it's a play, not a musical, though it is a play about music, where music is performed and even recorded by the cast. Now, why would they do that? This is a story about a band, about circa 1976, making an album in a studio, and they are going through it artistically and personally. Now, if that's not enough to entice music fans who, you know, say they don't like musical theater, here's more potential bait. The person responsible for the production's songs and music is Will Butler, formerly of the alternative rock band Arcade Fire. And Stereophonic happens Tuesday, October 21st through Sunday, October 26th.
From a band in the studio to an artist on tour, well, sort of. Tell us about Lauren Myers-Reese and their traveling show.
Reese, who is a local artist and educator, has an exhibition that's making the rounds within the three College of Southern Nevada campuses for the full 2025-2026 year. The show is called Prairie Princess Desert Dandy, and these are text-heavy paintings that tell the histories and accounts from many different sources hailing from early and modern-day Nevada, especially those from marginalized communities and or whose stories don't usually surface in the usual historical sources. These are very colorful works, and these colors will draw you in as much as the words and statements that are layered onto them. You can see this at CSN's Cheyenne campus through October 31st. If you miss it there, it's going to be at the Henderson campus the next day, and then over at the West Charleston campus for the spring, and it is free.
Well, it certainly sounds like Lauren has the entire Las Vegas Valley covered. So, Mike, what's your final recommendation?
So here's a primer on the Las Vegas Sinfonietta. It's a six-year-old chamber orchestra led by Tadas Kreisa, who is the conductor and, by the way, also the director of orchestras for UNLV and the artistic and music director of the Henderson Symphony Orchestra. Busy guy. The Sinfonietta boasts about 30 members, and they play a wide range of chamber styles from Baroque to contemporary. Their next concert, which is this Sunday, October 19th, is one of their up-close and personal concerts, and it's called The Art of the String Quartet. So a smaller sample of the Sinfonietta, obviously, but that's kind of the point of the concert. It's the intimacy of the quartet and the venue that they're highlighting. And the program consists of three works, one each by Haydn, Skorik, and Schubert. And they're sure to sound great in the hands of these musicians and through that crystal clear sound system of the Clark County Library Main Theater.
We'll have to leave it there. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Paul.